From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The center now presents a conversation about contemporary Japanese culture and society, including topics such as religion, politics and the law, and education. The speakers are Isaac Shapiro and Shuji Takashina. Mr. Shapiro was born in Japan. He's an attorney in New York, a trustee of the National Humanities Center, and was president of the Japan Society from 1970 till 1977. Professor Takashina is a scholar at the National Humanities Center on leave from the University of Tokyo, where he's an art historian.
I believe that one thing that distinguishes religion in Japan from religion in the United States is that it is such an inextricable part of the national culture. And it is not something which is debated. It is not something which creates issues, social issues, mm-hmm. or economic issues such as aid to parochial schools, that sort of thing. There is an area since World War II in which church-state relations have become an issue, but it attracts the attention of very few people. The Japanese courts, since the war and since the new constitution, have had to deal with church-state issues.
Are they separate?
Constitutionally and legally they're separate. Mm-hmm. Culturally they're not.
Yeah.
And when a decision comes down, as happened recently, on a church-state issue, it's the intellectual world and also the minority Christian sector, that is, the Christian circles, which are most concerned about the separation of church and state. I don't think there is a general consciousness on the part of the people of this constitutional principle. It's an alien principle, mm-hmm. because religion is so much a part of the everyday culture. You are surrounded by symbols. From the time you are born and conscious of your surroundings, there are religious symbols. They're a part of the history, a part of the everyday life. The festivals, which are not separate and apart from, let's say, national festivals, but all tied in together. Even the festivals that celebrate, let's say, used to be the legendary first emperor, which is now called Founders Day or Foundation Day, has a religious overtone.
One reads in the newspapers stories about the crime rate, for instance, in Japan, how much significantly lower it is in Japan than it is in America. Is this a result of this religious texture, the religious atmosphere?
What would you say, Professor Takashina? That's a difficult question.
Yes, I can't say that it's a direct result of the religious culture, but I can say safely that Japanese society is so much tightly connected, when the peoples are so tightly connected one another, and that I can also define a kind of religious relationship between your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
It all depends on how you define the religion. Mm-hmm. This religion, if I may call this religion, it doesn't have the established doctrine,
mm-hmm.
so we may call it a kind of discipline or a kind of a relationship between the neighbors. But the fact is that in Japanese society, I noticed that the relationship between human beings are so narrow and tight, and you are always surrounded by a kind of your fellow people. You are never isolated in Japanese society. And which makes yourself sometimes uncomfortable if you want to be quite independent.
Mm.
But in general, that makes Japanese society quite what we call the society of consensus, and which makes which makes it difficult for someone to make a contrary thing to the society.
There is quite a difference in the consciousness of Japanese people about law and the consciousness of Americans for historical and cultural reasons. We in the United States, with our English tradition, legal tradition, are very law conscious. We have a heightened sense of law consciousness, right consciousness, We look to the law to rule the society, to establish the rules by which people are governed, and the laws and punishment supply a very, I'd say, the central set of disciplines which prevents our society from being an anarchy. And that's something that is bred into us, has been over generations since the common law began.
Where does this come from in the Japanese, by contrast?
In the Japanese culture, it seems to me at least, based on my observation and my bias from having been educated in this country in the law, that there isn't the kind of law consciousness or right consciousness. And the sense of duty or obligation doesn't come from the law.
When you say right consciousness, you mean one's rights.
That's right, of going to court or going to a forum to enforce your rights. Thinking in terms of the rights of the citizen rather than the social obligations. And the obligations are not so much defined by the written law as they are here. Here, if you want to know what you can and can't do,
yeah,
you look at the law, or somebody advises you as to what the law is and what you can do and what you can't.
So it's a question of individual liberties, the perception here, in the two societies?
In the United States. In Japan, I think, as Professor Takashina suggested, the social unit provides the discipline. And you have a strong sense of your obligations, first because you are taught as a young child in school and at home what your duties are. And there is a stress on duties, which we don't have here in this country, not so much on rights.
And what would some of these duties be?
Well, one of the duties would be the duty to your neighbor, to your fellow villagers, to respect their sensitivities, their privacy, their person, and their property. Although I would say that in recent years, I think the number of property crimes in Japan has risen, especially white-collar crime. That's a whole nother subject, the distinction between the low rate of crime, of violent crime in Japan, and the relatively, for Japan, high rate of non-violent crimes.
So I think Professor Shapiro is quite right, yes, in stressing on this particular sentiment of community in Japan. If we do have, of course, law and every kind of legal rights and obligation, but as a Japanese living in the Japanese society, I think most of our fellow countrymen are not so conscious about the written law. And what we have to do is almost instinctively taught since childhood, and the legal right or legal rights or legal obligation is perhaps relatively less important than the trust or love for the neighbor or trust in the community. And you have to be in that community, and you must be conscious always of your fellow people.
What should Americans know about the Japanese? There are these all these stereotypes that float about.
That's true, yes. Yes, I think the most important thing about the contemporary Japanese society and culture is the coexistence of many styles, many trends, and many streams. You can paint a contemporary Japanese picture as a highly developed country with a very sophisticated technology and big national production. But you can also paint contemporary Japanese as still holding the traditional way of living, sometimes in the traditional house of wood and paper, and you put on the costume, a traditional costume, and all these kind of things. And the important thing, I think, is that these different styles, or these different cultures, peacefully coexist, and we don't feel quite not uneasy with them, and we are quite comfortable with having many different kind of life pattern. We have the completely Western style living life, for instance, in the office, but mm-hmm. in the family you have still the traditional way of living, and you don't have any discrepancy, you don't feel any discrepancy between them. And the important thing is that we accept all these kind of different things, which make the Japanese culture quite rich, and there are many trends. Even in art, we have accepted the Western style painting and Western style sculpture, but that doesn't mean the Western style replaced the Japanese traditional style. Japanese style painting still flourishes very much, and that makes the complexity and richness of the contemporary Japanese culture.
I fully subscribe to that. What I like to tell my American friends who ask me about Japan is that the similarities between Japan and the United States should never obscure the differences. The fact that the Japanese have adopted certain Western institutions, dress, style of architecture to a mm-hmm. limited extent, constitution, legal system, should not obscure the basically different culture and psychology. The religious aspects of life, I think psychologists would say, tends to influence the psychological behavior. And when you have such a difference, as you do between the religions in Japan and the culture and traditions in Japan, you will notice, if you analyze the behavior, that the basic psychological behavior is also different underneath the surface similarities. And
what would be an example, for instance, a concrete example of this psychological
disparity?
Without
putting any critical value on it, I would say, just as a matter of analysis, Western logic and thesis, antithesis, synthesis, that whole mode of thought, which is so natural for us because of our heritage and our tradition,
is alien to the Japanese.
Is alien to the not only the Japanese mind, but also, I suppose, the Chinese. The universality of mind is very typical of the Oriental mind. The acceptance of acausal relationships without cause and effect, the chance nature, that is, life as it is lived and as it is viewed, which is why I think the Japanese have such a strong bond with nature.
Is this called mysticism?
I don't think so. I think mysticism is something else. It's in the Japanese vernacular, Japan is an awase culture, that is, a culture where you adapt to your surroundings, and you adapt also to the chancity or chanceness, I don't know the word.
The randomness,
the way in which life mm-hmm. progresses.
How would you characterize the cultural commerce between Japan and America?
Well, that's something that, of course, I have spent a good deal of time on as president of Japan Society for 7 years, when I was directly involved in cultural exchange and saw the rise in the volume of communications, the number of people communicating in both directions. I would say that there are no two countries that I know of that have developed their cultural exchanges and ties in as conscious a way, have spent so much time and so much money, and I think with remarkable success, as the United States and Japan. Putting aside the current economic and political frictions, that if you look around the world, Japan is almost unique in the sympathetic way it looks at America, the acceptance of American values. I don't mean necessarily the adoption, but the acceptance, the friendly attitude, the favorable attitude towards America and American culture is remarkable in Japan. And one thing that impresses me, Professor Takashina has much more contact with Japanese youth than I do, but my sense of it is that particularly among Japanese youth, there is a favorable image of America.
That's true, yes.
Shuji, how would you characterize some of the important similarities and differences in education in Japan and the United States?
I think we have, of course, many similarities between the United States and Japan concerning the education system. After the World War II, we adopted many kind of American systems, such as college or university system. Japanese people are known very hardworking, and so the Japanese children asked to work very hard since the very beginning, and especially in the primary and secondary level of education, they have a lot of work to do. The average standard is fairly high in Japan, and I think this is quite characteristic of Japanese society. That is to say that we are very homogeneous, and the middle class and the middle standard is very high.
Yeah, I would add to that not only is it true that Japanese children work harder, but they expect to work harder. They don't expect education necessarily to be pleasurable or fun. They are not inspired to learn because of the pleasures that learning gives, or supposed pleasure, but because they are taught to believe that education is essential, and that if they work hard, they will progress. The examination system is such that it is by and large a meritocracy. There are gradations among schools, and the children aspire to go to the best schools that they can go to, and therefore they have to take tests, and if they can't go to the best schools, then they have to go to the next best schools, and there is that hierarchy of educational institutions. But the general interest and excitement, I think, is widespread. That is, the supposed high rate of literacy here is probably not as high as it appears to be, because we have so many children who are functionally illiterate, who may have some basic knowledge of reading and writing and know the alphabet, but they aren't able to express themselves either in writing or orally, or understand, or spell.
Isaac Shapiro is an attorney in New York City and was president of the Japan Society from 1970 till 1977. Shuji Takashina, a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, is an art historian at the University of Tokyo. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. How would the philosopher Plato respond to the modern world? Scholars and critics will naturally disagree about finding answers to such a question, but most would probably begin by examining Plato's world in ancient Greece and by noting some parallels between society and antiquity and the way we live today. On that account, here are the comments of Helen North, a professor of classics at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania and a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center.
But I was much struck years ago when I was reading one of the ancient critics who said, if Zeus spoke Greek, he would talk like Plato. And the same critic, in another context, was describing how after Plato died, they found among his papers, or I suppose his papyri, a number of versions of the first sentence of the Republic, which he had written and rewritten until he got exactly the right order, the right emphasis, the right nuances of style. And Dionysius of Halicarnassus, who is the critic I'm talking about, accused Plato of combing and curling and braiding his sentences. And this made me aware, if I hadn't been aware before, of the close attention that Plato paid to the mode of expression as well as to what he was saying. If one is true to Plato and the concept that he ultimately developed of what he came to call a philosophical or a true rhetoric, there is no distinction between substance and style. And one of the things I'm interested in when I study Plato's rhetoric is the extent to which the philosophical concept and the mode of expression, in a sense, shape each other.
Does rhetoric mean argument?
Not necessarily. One of the popular definitions of rhetoric in antiquity was simply that it was the art of persuasion through words. To confine oneself to the Greeks, we find a great deal of rhetoric and persuasion in Homer. Long before Homer, certain types of argumentation had been developed. And when you go from Homer through archaic poetry to tragedy in the 5th century, you see at once that the Greeks are naturally rhetorical, and they are the masters of many arts of persuasion. Now, in the latter part of the 5th century, these arts were formalized and made into a consistent body of teaching by the Sophists. And these were the teachers who aroused such opposition on the part of conservatives in the late 5th century. We see them attacked, for example, in tragedy and in comedy, in the Historians. And Socrates, if we can believe Plato, was very much disturbed both by the immorality of the teaching of the Sophists and by the inartistic nature of their mode of persuasion.
Did all of this come down to politics? One group of people trying to manipulate another group of people?
It was very important in politics. In fact, the reason why the Sophists were so successful, and they really revolutionized Greek education from the late 40s in the 5th century, such men as Protagoras and Gorgias and Hippias and Prodicus, the reason they had such an enormous welcome in the various Greek city-states that they visited was that they professed to instruct people in what they called arete politike. Political excellence would be a literal translation, but political success, or success in the art of politics, was what they really meant. And they succeeded in attracting huge audiences. If you read Plato's Protagoras, you get a marvelous picture of how the young men of Athens, of a certain class, a certain degree of wealth, were enormously excited when the news came that Protagoras was visiting in Athens. They could go and listen to him talk.
Did these Sophists achieve rhetorical success at the expense of public morality, political morality?
Well, this, of course, is what Plato would have us believe in the so-called early Socratic dialogues. I'm not taking any stand on their chronology, but we do have a series of enormously influential dialogues in which Plato represents Socrates as being in discussion with various prominent Sophists. Protagoras, Hippias, Gorgias among them.
Now, is he trying to expose them? Or
he is trying to expose the immorality of their teaching, and also, and this is a thing that I find particularly interesting, he is very critical of the techniques of persuasion that they use. I think that Plato's opposition to sophistic rhetoric was based partly on his fundamental opposition to what he conceived of as their immoral perversion in ethics and politics.
Are we talking about sexual ethics? Or
no, we are not really. We're talking about making the worse appear the better reason, using argumentation that appeals to the emotions rather than the intellect, persuading people to vote for courses of conduct in the assembly or to convict or acquit people in the courtrooms and the juries, not on the basis of truth, but on the basis of opinion. And it was, of course, never the purpose of the Sophists to do anything except persuade and teach people to persuade. It seems not to have occurred to many of them, and why should it, that their aim should be to improve people, to leave them better than they found them.
So the means justified the ends.
This certainly is the view that the Platonic Socrates constantly ascribes to the Sophists. And in the course of attacking the willingness of the Sophists to accept opinion rather than knowledge, appearance rather than reality, Plato adds to this an attack on their modes of argumentation in which they try to gratify their audiences. There's a Greek verb, charizasthai, which means to gratify, related to the word charis, which means grace or pleasure or adornment. And it is used in a very pejorative sense in Platonic attacks on the sophists, because to gratify people is to appeal to their lower instincts, to try to persuade them to do something on the basis of what they think is good, but which they do not know to be good.
What would Plato have said about all the mass marketing of politicians today? Is that the equivalent of sophistry?
Oh, it certainly is. And whenever one studies Plato's attacks on sophistic rhetoric, all one can think of is, suppose he ever sat in front of a television instrument. Mm-hmm. Suppose he saw not just the marketing of politicians, but the marketing of goods. I mean, this is the real manifestation of sophistic rhetoric in our own time.
Well, just how naive are we? Where did we ever come up with the notion that politics approaches truth?
We came up against it, for one thing, in Plato, because so far as he was concerned, in something like the Apology and or a dialogue like the Gorgias, he condemns in memorable terms the greatest of the Athenian statesmen, people like Pericles, people like Simon Themistocles.
Now, he's not calling them liars. He's qualifying it, as
well,
I understand you.
He comes very close to this. He shows that in each case, instead of leaving Athens better than they found the city, they left them worse, bloated with armaments, with walls, with navies and so on, but knowing less and less about what their true good consists of. But I think that we could go to the Phaedrus, the dialogue in which he makes, I would say, his most positive contributions to a theory of philosophical rhetoric. And he shows that to be a philosophical rhetorician, you must have a knowledge of truth. And here, of course, is the difference between his ideal rhetorician and the sophistic rhetors, who were interested not in reality, but in appearance, not in knowledge, but in opinion. He says that you must have a knowledge of truth, and you must have a knowledge of the souls whom you are striving to persuade. And that becomes very interesting, because what he is doing, in essence, is combining dialectic with psychology. And he, in fact, uses a description of rhetoric, which is not new with him. It had been used before. But he uses the Greek word psychagogia, which means a leading of souls. Psyche is soul. Agen means to lead. And he thinks of the rhetorician as being able to lead the soul in whatever direction he wishes. But he must, therefore, know the soul. And not only that, he really gives us a counsel of perfection, which the later philosophical rhetoricians really had to bring to terms with reality. Plato thought that you should know every soul in your audience and know the arguments that would persuade that soul, which is a clue, of course, to the fact that he really has always believed, never abandoned the belief, that the ideal way of teaching and persuading was one-to-one. One cannot read the dialogues of Plato, the Republic, for example, with the picture of how the ideal state becomes corrupted stage by stage, as one after another the various desires and passions take over, without knowing that Plato conceived himself to be living in a corrupt society. He knew that from the moment when Socrates was put to death.
Helen North was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. She's professor of classics at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for a discussion of contemporary Japanese society and culture and a conversation about the Greek philosopher Plato. Two experts at the National Humanities Center discuss Japanese religion, politics, and law, and education. In another segment this week on Soundings, a distinguished classicist from Swarthmore College notes some parallels between ancient societies and the way we live today, and conjectures about how Plato might respond to the modern world his thinking and writing helped to create. Listen this week for Soundings.